listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world. Simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide, and on Progressive Voices on TuneIn Radio. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Pleased to have you with us, and pleased to have Neil McCabe back with us, conservative commentator, editor of Guns and Patriots newsletter, gunsandpatriots.com. And hey, Neil, welcome back.
Hey, really glad to be with you, Tom.
There is a fascinating article about this, the NRA's new multi-million-dollar ad campaign. In fact, the title of it is "The NRA's Multi-Million-Dollar New Ad Campaign is Despicable," and in which
Why read the article, Tom? I think we know everything we need to know.
Yeah, in the wake of all these killings, this little girl, this 9-year-old girl killing the instructor. I mean, literally over at rawstory.com, every day they've got a story up about somebody who was killed unnecessarily, accidentally, 100% of the time. You know, some usually children. And because these things happen not just every day, they happen every couple hours in the United States of America.
Well, it's a big country, Tom, and there's a lot of people who have guns, and unfortunately there are accidents, just like there are accidents with people crossing the street, and there are accidents, people accidentally hanging themselves with belts, and so we don't outlaw belts. I mean, it's just one of those things.
Well, if you know, we're 5% of the world's population. If we and we have 50% of the world's private guns in private hands. If we had 50% of the world's belts in private hands, if we had 50% of the world's roads, then make some sense.
Why don't we help open up some freedom in China? And then they'll have a billion guns, and we'll even out that ratio. I mean, just because countries restrict freedom doesn't mean we should emulate them.
Isn't that sort of like saying, you know, in Liberia you have the freedom to get Ebola, and we really need to open that up to the world?
No, Tom, I don't mean that we should all get Ebola or that's
well,
not
guns
what I mean.
Kill people. I mean, guns are a major public health. In fact, they're one of the leading causes of accidental death in the United States, and you know, second or third to car accidents. So, if this is a major public health problem, just like Ebola is a major public health problem, you know, why is the NRA opposed to our dealing with it as such? In fact, why have they paid Republican congressmen to pass a law that makes it a crime for the guys at the CDC to compile gun death statistics?
Well, because there is a movement to sort of reframe gun rights as a health issue.
But it is.
Well, not everybody accepts that, Tom.
Well, when people die from something, how is that not public health?
Well, Tom, I think it's already against the law to kill people, and I think that everyone
understands. These are accidental deaths, Neil.
Well, everyone understands.
Accidental deaths are not against the law.
But accidents happen, so people fall off the stairs, and so people don't use the railing. I mean, there are things that happen. This is, you know, this girl shooting the instructor with the Uzi was a horrific, horrific accident. And
it wouldn't have happened if she wasn't holding
a gun. And it was a horrific, I don't know how to say this, but it's just bad decision making on the part of that instructor. And
he was complying with the law in the state of Georgia. She was a year older than she needed to be.
But it was a mistake, and not everything that is a mistake is against the law, Tom, because this is a free country.
My point. That throws it into the category of public health.
But I will tell you this, that because of this accident, every gun range in America is refocused and reaffirmed on safety. I mean, the gun ranges and gun owners are the safest people in the world when it comes to these things. I mean, you yourself have interacted with target shooters and other
people. I'm one myself. I don't just interact with them. I do target shooting.
And so you understand that when you're doing target shooting, I'm guessing that virtually every range you've been to has been absolutely let down.
Target shooting, Neil, with my brother and sister-in-law, who are both licensed gun owners. They both have concealed carry permits. Their guns are registered. They, you know, were doing it in an insured environment on their mm-hmm. property. You know, that's a whole different thing from, oh, hey, 9-year-old, here you go, here's an Uzi.
There hasn't been an accident on this range in years, and I will tell you that. You know, so I've been on ranges run, you know, in the U.S. Army and other military services. You know, Marines get shot every year accidentally. Marine ranges are certainly not lax, goofy environments. General Petraeus was shot in a range accident before he deployed
Neil,
to Iraq.
Soldiers have to have guns.
Yes, they do.
The guy who's living next door to you doesn't.
He may want to, though.
If he wants to, let him do it in a way that is safe. Let him do it. Let him have a locked gun cabinet. Let him have liability insurance.
It's a twofold problem. The first problem is whether or not it's good or bad policy. And the second problem is that we have a constitutional issue, a hurdle that, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, you never really talk about is if you want to make this case, you can make this case in a constitutional way. You can call a convention.
There's nothing constitutional about this, Neil. We're not talking about militias. The Second Amendment says in order to maintain a well-regulated militia.
Didn't we settle this? Is this already? We're still
it's not settled. Just because some bozo on the Supreme Court says it doesn't make it so. Ask Abe Lincoln. They decided Dred Scott. They said, you know, sorry, slavery, even Missouri can now be a slave state. And Abe Lincoln came along and said, just because the Supreme Court decided it doesn't mean I have to follow it. Andrew Jackson said the same thing about the Trail of Tears. Screw the Supreme Court.
So what you're saying is you're willing to enact a Trail of Tears again?
No.
I don't understand, Tom. What I'm saying is that
in Heller, when the Supreme Court, you know, somehow mysteriously and magically discovered that the Second Amendment doesn't actually refer to militias, even though those are the first words of the Second Amendment, and decided to basically bend over and kiss the butt of the NRA. And you know how political the Supreme Court is. You've got several members who regularly go to events all over the country sponsored by the Koch brothers, not for the right-wingers.
The Democratic whip of the Supreme Court.
It is all way too partisan. They should not have this kind of power. The Constitution does not give them this kind of power. But we are wandering far afield. You're saying it's settled. I'm saying it's not. The Supreme Court might rule a different way if the composition of the court changes, which is why the court shouldn't have this kind of power in the first place.
Thing, Tom, is, you know, does the NRA have a right to have an ad campaign? Yes. Does the
Under
NRA
current law?
Yes. And, you know, one of the problems that the NRA has is you were talking about Republicans standing up for gun rights. That's a shocking mischaracterization of the Republican Party's activities when it comes to gun rights. The Republican Party has done nothing for gun rights, and the NRA
The Republican sort of Party has made it a felony for an employee at the Centers for Disease Control to simply compile statistics on gun deaths. How is that doing nothing for the NRA?
That's the biggest wet kiss I've
ever heard of.
Well, Tom, it's a felony to spend money that isn't appropriated by Congress. So, I mean, yes.
You're describing the mechanism by which they made it illegal.
Anything else that someone did on their own.
This is not included. This is specifically excluded, Neil, by law.
Yes, because it's something we don't want them doing. We want them.
Well, I would like them doing it. If you've got, you know, 5, 10, 15,000 people a year dying from gun accidents, I mean, that's right up there with, you know, major causes of death. I mean, I'd like to know why.
You'd all like to know why, Tom.
Well, I can tell you why. It's because we're 5% of the world's population. We have half the guns in civilians' hands in the world.
Square, Tom.
Say what?
More guns in China.
More guns in China. Okay. Well, you never know, Neil. Neil McCabe, conservative counsel at gunsandpatriots.com. Thanks for dropping by, Neil.
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
It's always good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, you know, interesting. And Ray Rice gets kicked out of the NFL. We can get into that. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. The vote in the Senate. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Brenda in, how do you say that? Sepulpa, Oklahoma?
Yep. Sepulpa. You got it.
Great. So, Brenda, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. You wanted to talk about interactions with the police?
Yes. I mean, I live in Oklahoma, and there's a tremendous amount of police shootings. I know that you said yesterday about it's hard to try a police officer for, I don't know what happened to excessive force. I haven't heard the term excessive force used in guns gunning down, you know, I don't care if they were running from them. Yeah. I don't care what the deal was. There was a guy who had a knife, and he got shot like 9 times in the back.
Yeah.
9 times in the back.
Right.
And the state trooper was, he's all good.
Yeah.
You know, and they put him on administrative leave, paid leave. You know, we had a guy gunned down. He was off duty, of course. He gunned down some boy.
So you kill somebody, you get a paid vacation.
Yeah, no, but yeah, he gets a paid vacation. He gets to sit in there, think of a good defense. They don't arraign him, you know, because they're thinking of what they, you know what's going on with that.
Yep.
Meanwhile, he's getting paid. This kid can't get buried, okay? Well, somewhere I heard, I don't know if it's in Oklahoma, about them shooting somebody 80 times.
Yeah.
Because the guy had a pellet gun. That's called suicide by cop. I've got mental illness. I've thought about that several times. That's what this world's coming to.
Yeah, I'm not for
that kind of thing. But I'm telling you that, you know, in Oklahoma, pull it up, see how many shootings there is a month of the police shooting somebody,
yeah.
And they get all cleared.
So it would be really interesting to get some stats on suicide by cop. I you know, it's a bizarre commentary on the country we live in. When, you know, 30 years ago, suicide by cop was damn near impossible. It was very hard to get the police to kill you. And now it's very easy. And it's what a change. I mean, what an amazing and profound change.
I don't understand. I don't understand why it is they are allowed. If you have a criminal record, you know, when they gunned the guy down with the knife, and the knife wasn't even out, okay?
Right.
Knife's in his pocket.
Right.
Okay, they said, well, he tested positive for meth. Oh, well, that makes it okay for him to get shot 8 times in the back.
Right.
That's not – nobody uses excessive force anymore. Do you ever hear that term?
No, we are hearing it around, for example, Michael Brown, but I'm not seeing Officer Wilson being charged with it.
Well, I'm not seeing anybody get charged with excessive force anymore. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If it had been a pharmacy getting robbed and they shot a kid 8 times, that guy would be tried for murder.
Right.
I promise you. I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
You know, but the police, no, not in a million years. And some of the stuff yesterday was great, talking about initiations. That's it exactly. There's so many dirty cops doing dirty things. You know, they got to have their buddy. They need to know they got something on you.
Yeah.
You know, and I've witnessed it here. And this is a state where, you know, they told me, the first thing they told me is, you ain't a real Okie till you get a Department of Corrections number.
And you're a real Okie, a real citizen of Oklahoma? That's incredible. Brenda, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your story with us. It's 20 minutes, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. Today, Ray Rice. We didn't get into this yesterday, and I normally I don't talk much about sports, but this is really a much larger issue, and it's how we as Americans are dealing with domestic abuse. Domestic abuse is one of those issues that, arguably 100 years ago, it was just the way it is, right? Men beat up women. So what? It was a non-issue, I've often said that in many ways, misogyny is, if not worse than racism, at least it's the other shoe dropping, right? It is the hatred of women, the oppression of women. I don't think that this is absolutely proves the point, but we got a black president before we got a female president, for example. African Americans were given the right to vote in the 1870s. Women were given the right to vote in the 1920s, in 1920. It has been a long road and a tough haul for women. And it still is. Women earn 70 cents for every dollar that men work. Women are massively underrepresented in the workplace, particularly in the senior offices, the executive offices, in Congress. Now, it's slowly changing, but, you know, part of this is our attitude toward domestic violence. And Ray Rice punches his girlfriend out in the elevator to the point that she's unconscious. And originally the NFL said, oh, okay, we'll slap him on the wrist, two games off. Which would mean that he'd be playing, what, next week, I think? And we just had the first game of the season for his team. Say that again, Shane. Second one's Thursday, thank you. And isn't it time for us to just say enough already? And by the way, this doesn't just apply to football players beating up girlfriends, fiancés in elevators. There's a woman who has been calling out gamers, for example, for the way women are treated in video games. Women in video games are basically either wallpaper, sex objects, in many cases abusive sex objects. In other words, you know, beat up the woman, rape the woman, kill the woman. But, you know, almost never the heroines of the story. Now, I get it. You know, most gamers are boys. But is this the message we want to be teaching boys? Yesterday we had a conversation with a fellow. I don't remember if it was a caller or a guest who you know, went on at some length about. I'm pretty sure it was a caller. It was our guest. Who went on at some length about, how, well, you know, the traditional role of women has always, or of men has always been, you know, the protector. The caretaker, the provider. And I'm like, yeah, that has been the traditional role of men. And who came up with that role? Men! Surprise! And so now that women are getting some power, they're saying, you know, doesn't have to be that way. In fact, maybe that's not even the best way. And when you look historically, you look at older cultures, you look at Native American cultures, Asian, European, African, Aboriginal cultures, what do you find in South American Aboriginal cultures? In a really significant, perhaps large minority or small majority, women run communities. In the Iroquois Confederacy, it was five nations. It was originally four, and then they added another, a fifth one. And in those five nations, four of the five nations, men could not vote. Women ran the show. The men were the sachems. They would travel the long distances for the annual or semi-annual meetings or biannual meetings of the larger confederacy. But they did not have the power to say anything other than here's what my community thinks, and the community voted on what they thought, and it was the women who did the vote. Why? Because the Iroquois Confederacy's constitution said all decisions are made in the context of its impact on the seventh generation. Can you imagine? And everybody understood that the men weren't all that concerned about the seventh generation, but the women were having babies. They got it. Can you imagine if our legislature, if our constitution, and Franklin and those guys had this opportunity. Ben Franklin brought 34 elders of the Iroquois Confederacy to the Constitutional Convention in August, or maybe it was July, in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia. He brought these guys, and for the first week or so, they were there. They did the opening blessing ceremony of the Constitutional Convention. John Hancock made a big speech welcoming them and thanking them. James Madison did too. Franklin, of course, introduced them. He said, hey, here's a model for us, the Iroquois Confederacy. And this wasn't meant as an insult when he said, you know, if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a bond which has stood in peace for over 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen should be able to do the same. He meant that as a compliment. And that's what he said. So is it time for us to reinvent our norms? Could it be that we've had a dysfunctional and sick society for hundreds of years, that might account for slavery, it might account for the genocide of the Native Americans, this male-dominated society? Is it time for us to wake up and change things?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And is the beginning of that wake up when we see Ray Rice beat the crap out of his girlfriend saying, "No, buddy, you're not going to be rich anymore." The bad and the very, very orgulously ugly, the good. Panera Bread. The sandwich chain joined Starbucks, Chipotle, Target, and a host of other companies today, yesterday, in asking its customers to stop bringing guns into their restaurant. Panera issued this statement announcing the move. "Within our company, we strive to create Panera warmth. This warmth means bakery cafes where customers and associates feel comfortable and welcome. To this end, we ask that guns not be brought into this environment unless carried by an authorized law enforcement officer. Panera respects the rights of gun owners, but asks our customers to help preserve the environment we are working to create for our guests and our associates." Just insane that anyone would think they need to bring a weapon of war into a sandwich shop. Good on Panera for doing the common sense thing, even if it means angering the gun nut lobby. The bad. Oakleaf High School. The Orange Park, Florida high school is under fire this week for the way it punished a 15-year-old student when she unknowingly violated the dress code. Check it out.
When 15-year-old Miranda Larkin went to school in this black skirt, she says she didn't know she was in violation of Oakleaf High School's dress code.
She just points at me from, like, across the hall. She goes, "Your skirt is too short."
She says the teacher sent her to the school nurse, who told her she had to put on this outfit, a neon yellow T-shirt and bright red sweatpants. Written on both were the words "dress code violation." Larkin just moved to Clay County from Seattle and was on her third day at a new school.
She put on the outfit in the bathroom and looked at herself in the mirror and just broke down.
You know, in a way, this plays into the topic we were just talking about. Why is it that schools are enforcing rules to keep girls from distracting boys? Shouldn't boys just get over it? I mean, why are they only applied to girls? Whatever you think about dress codes, there's absolutely no, zero justification for humiliating a 15-year-old kid. Oakleaf High School should be ashamed of itself. And the very, very ugly, Brian Kilmeade. During Monday's edition of Fox and Friends, the Fox so-called news host joked about the now infamous video of Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice punching his wife in an elevator. Seriously, check it out.
I think the message is take the stairs.
The message is, when you're in an elevator, there's a camera.
Yeah.
And there's a camera right now on Heather Nauert, who's got the headline.
Hi.
Right. Actually, Brian, the lesson here is that domestic abuse is a serious problem. The fact that anyone would even consider making light of the Ray Rice situation isn't just disturbing. It's very, very ugly. That's interesting. The good, bad, and ugly. The bad was what's referred to as slut-shaming these days, which is, you know, trashing women because men find them attractive. And the other one was male violence. Right on to the topics that we're talking about here. And I think these are really consequential topics. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I am so sick of these gun nuts. They seem to think their right to own guns are more important than anybody else's rights. I live in Texas, and I have to be afraid when I go out, you know, what I'm going to say to somebody, because I might say the wrong thing, and you can carry a gun everywhere here. So doesn't that interfere with my freedom of speech?
Right. And yeah, it does. And it's not just your freedom of speech. It's your freedom to feel safe in your immediate environment. I mean, in the state in which you live.
Yeah, in essence, my pursuit of life, liberty, my right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Exactly. This is why in Tombstone, Arizona, you go through the list of all these old Western towns, and anybody who's ever actually read old Westerns, particularly the Westerns that were written in the early part of the 20th century, where they're actually fairly historically accurate, when you ride into town, there would be a sign that says, "Check your guns with the sheriff's office." And, you know, you get a check card. I mean, it's like checking your coat when you go to the opera kind of thing. And people were not allowed to open carry guns in Dodge or in Tombstone or in any of these, you know, kind of famous Wild West, in any Western towns, basically, because people understood it was a risk to to public safety. Anita, thank you very much. Very well said. Ken, in Ticonderoga, New York. Hey, Ken, you wanted to get back to Ray Rice.
Yeah. In the same summer that the NFL decided to crack down on hands to the face, isn't it interesting that they basically gave Ray Rice a pass for aggravated assault?
And he punched his fiancée in the face. So had he done that on the football field, it would have earned him a year suspension? I mean, it's a fairly major thing, isn't it? I'm sorry, I'm not all that familiar with NFL rules.
And, well, this summer they decided to crack down on receivers being bumped off the line and issued, a record number of penalties during the preseason to get these guys to ease up on the receivers. Again, compare and contrast.
Right.
Ag assault, slap on the wrist, hands to the face in a violent sport, 15 yards times cost you the game.
Right. And what was Ray Rice's position with the Ravens?
Running back.
So he was not a receiver.
No, great running back.
Yeah.
But it all goes back to what you were talking about before, and it's patriarchal societies versus matriarchal societies. I didn't know that about the Iroquois Confederation. Makes a heck of a lot more sense than letting a bunch of bozo guys run the show.
Well, and in fact, when Franklin brought these guys to the Constitutional Convention, John Adams was there, and this is in my book on equal protection. You can read the actual letters. Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, who was the second First Lady of the United States, but this was before even Washington had become president. They were writing the Constitution. Abigail Adams wrote a letter to her husband. She was in Virginia, Maryland, wherever she was, and Massachusetts, I think she was. She was outside of Boston, and he was down in Philadelphia. And she wrote a letter to him and said, please do not forget the ladies. In other words, make sure that this Constitution gives women rights. And he wrote back saying, you can depend that we will not give up our male prerogatives. And then she wrote back to him saying, if you men do that, you shall see a revolution on the part of the women. And so they did not write the word male into the Constitution. There were numerous states in 1789 when the Constitution was ratified and the United States began that allowed women to vote. And it was over the next 40 years that the vote for women was stripped on a state-by-state, municipality-by-municipality basis until by 1830 there was no place in the United States where a woman could legally vote. But it wasn't in the Constitution. And it didn't get written into the Constitution until the 14th Amendment in the 1870s. And the 14th Amendment says that the number of representatives, that will be based on the number of male electors, the male voters in the states. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton aggressively and Susan B. Anthony aggressively opposed the 14th Amendment, not because they didn't think that African-Americans should have equal access to the legal system, which is basically what the 14th Amendment's all about, but because it has the word male in it twice. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, if you put the word male into this dictionary, it'll take a constitution, it will take 100 years to get it out. And that was 1873 that thing was put in, and I think it was 1974 that the first really serious with teeth, workplace discrimination against women law went into place. So it was certainly the year that that the federal government made it illegal for credit card companies to refuse to give single woman credit cards, which was common practice up until 1974. My own wife, Louise, could not get a credit card in her own name until she got married, and then it had to be in my name. So, I remember those times. It's a bizarre tale.
And full circle, when you treat people like property, you can very easily cross the line and treat people badly.
Yes. Like, and in fact, you more often than not will. I mean, if anything, the history of slavery, the history of violence against women in this country, or just the removal of rights. I mean, this is the essence of ISIS, right? This is the essence of the Taliban. Put women in the burqa. It's interesting. There was some photographs that have recently been colorized, and it makes them so much more real. These photographs in the late 19th century, the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. There was like about 30 of them that were on Democratic Underground last week, and over the weekend, Louise and I were looking at them, And there was a picture of two women walking down the street in New York City in 1890. And women did not have the vote at that time. And there were all these laws. Women could not own property. Women could not execute a will. Women could not sue in court. Women basically had no rights at that point in time. And these two women, this was on Fifth Avenue. It was next to Central Park. And these women were dressed. They had hats on, so their heads were covered. And they were dressed in these long dresses. They were very fashionable, but they went all the way down to their wrists, and their dress went below their shoes. So you literally, the only parts of these women you could see were their face and their hands. And I was like, how is this different from Saudi Arabia right now? It's like, you know, we have a history of saying to women, sorry, you cannot, you know, how dare you? This is just like this little girl in this high school, you know, her skirt was an inch too short. Oh, my God, you may distract the men. It's all about the men. So.
And that's right where the Republicans want to take us, not to the 1950s, sure. The 1850s.
I agree. And in fact, actually, quite literally, because they want to roll back the consequence of the Civil War, which is a strong federal government, and they want to go back to a weak federal government and strong states. The whole states' rights thing. Ken, excellent points. Thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. How would the United States look and behave? Well, how would our country be different? And might we have fewer wars if women played a larger role in our body politic?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Remember, the only person who voted against the Iraq invasion? Barbara Lee. Barbara Lee, the only person. A woman. No coincidence there, I think. Welcome back. Keith in Landrum, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Last night, Senator Franklin was on the Lawrence O'Donnell Show, and they were talking about the passage of a cloture vote for getting money out of politics.
Senator Franken? Yeah, Al Franken?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
My basic question is, everybody complains that Senator Reid is holding up so many bills, and Senator Franken mentioned that this was a ploy by Republicans.
Keith, I can't quite hear you. Could you talk a little more directly into your microphone on your phone?
The Republicans keep saying that Senator Reid keeps holding up bills.
Right.
And Senator Franken made the comment last night that this was another attempt by Republicans to hold up other bills. So my question is, do you have a website that you could link to on your website, Dummies for Senate Rules, so we can understand exactly what the Senate rules are? And
Senate Rules for Dummies.
They are. And,
that's brilliant.
Yeah,
if there's not such a site.
Well, there needs to be, because now we have another 30-hour debate. It's going to hold up other bills while they discuss the issue, this, that, and the other. And
right. Maybe
it can explain things like the last government shutdown and how Harry Reid could not initiate new bills because of the complications that were, you know, that came up over that. I mean,
right.
I basically understand the rules, but trying to explain that to my Republican friends is fruitless.
Yeah. That's a great suggestion, Keith. I don't know of such a site, but maybe Sue does, and Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room, and maybe some of the folks in the chat room do. Maybe they can track it down, and Sue can get it on our website and in our newsletter. If there is no such site, it is certainly needed. I'm totally with you. Senate Rules for Dummies. Absolutely. Keith, thanks a lot for the call. Michelle in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Michelle.
Hi, Tom. This Ray Rice issue, and if you can be a little patient, this is a big step. I'm speaking out. I've been through this myself. When I saw that video, I realized that's what it must have looked like had I been a third-person observer when it happened to me.
So you were the victim of domestic abuse, domestic violence.
Yes, and I was able to kind of duck, but I did fall over backwards over the back of a sofa, and long story short, I did end up with a broken elbow, but I didn't take the blow to the face or to the head,
whoa,
which might have resulted in the same thing that Janae ended up with.
Right.
I don't like to use the term victim, because that word in and of itself has become a pejorative.
Yep.
In part, I think, in certain parts of politics with Mitt Romney using the term victim.
Yeah. So you were on the receiving end of domestic violence. Should we say it that way?
That's a good way to put it. It was an event that occurred.
Yeah.
And I was on the receiving end. I can tell you I've been through the system, and I can tell you exactly going through the system why women don't act the way many from the outside might expect. And I can tell you in the first place, I did run next door, was able to call the police. And I can tell you in the very first place, they showed up and I have three great big cops in my kitchen. They tried to talk me out of pressing charges in the first place.
Wow. Yeah, I'm not surprised, Michelle. I thank you for the call and sharing your story with us. This is domestic violence. It's the media is going to treat domestic violence as if it exists in a vacuum. It does not exist in a vacuum. It's the predictable result of, 1,000 years of this. We'll be back. Shano says, Senate.gov Rule 22 is the filibuster, but this goes beyond that. This is, why do they have 30 hours of debate? Why, this, that, and the other thing. Can somebody come up with Senate rules for dummies? That would be an interesting one. Dan in Omaha, Nebraska, you wanted to talk about Ray Rice?
Yes. You're going to jump all over me for this, but when I got to see this second film, I saw two drunks, and I'm not justifying anything that Ray Rice did. All I'm saying is that two irresponsible people did this. His wife, then girlfriend, had apologized for what they did. I think they both know that what they did was in the heat of the moment when they shouldn't have been actually drinking. I'm not justifying anything. I just
Well, actually, you are. You're saying it was because he was drinking, and that's not a legitimate excuse. And others have said, oh, it looks like she hit him first. Well, maybe, but did she hit him with enough force to knock him unconscious? I mean, there's something about proportion.
No, she lunged at him.
Right.
She didn't strike him or anything like that. She lunged at him, and he responded. I'm not justifying that. I'm saying that there were two people that were probably under the influence, and that's what we saw.
But so what?
Well, okay, so what? I'm just saying that there were two irresponsible people.
If you are 40 years ago, if you were drunk and you killed somebody, at least if you were white, you could probably mount an impaired decision defense, and you might get off on manslaughter, or you might get off altogether. In fact, probably getting off altogether was more common than not, certainly maybe 100 years ago. Now, that I was drunk defense doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And if it doesn't work for murder, it doesn't work for assault. And I just don't buy it. If somebody's got a drinking problem, that's a separate issue. This guy has a violence problem.
There were two drunks.
Pardon?
I wasn't saying there was a drinking problem. I said there were two drunks.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I was saying, pardon Shane, I still can't hear him. He's not talking loud enough. What did you say?
You're
equivocating.
Me.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Back to you, Dan.
Okay, all I'm saying is that there were two drunks.
I get that.
Irresponsible moves.
Okay, all right. You're
that's
on the right.
That's what I'm saying.
Got it. Okay, Dan, thank you very much. John, in Port Isabel, Texas, you wanted to get back to my discussion with Neil about gun accidents on military ranges? John, listening to Sirius in Port Isabel, Texas? Okay, Joyce in Decatur, Georgia. Hey, Joyce, you wanted to get back to Ray Rice?
Yes, Tom. I just want to see if you could help me with this here. I don't believe in domestic violence. Let me get that straight. But last month, we had a black man killed by a white cop. White cop went on paid leave. We had two black men killed by white cops. We had a white cop beat a woman side the road, beat her bloody. She had to go to the hospital. He went on paid leave. Didn't lose his health benefits. Now we got Ray Rice, okay? He has a fight with his wife in the elevator, knocks her out. She comes to. He's terminated from his job.
Right.
Now, the only thing the difference that I see in that is that these cops are white and he's black. Two people got killed. Cops were on paid leave. One woman got beat upside the road, beat her bloody. He went on paid leave. She went to the hospital and was jailed. Now, what I can see with Ray Rice, I believe he probably should, maybe took some time off, but to lose his job, don't have any pay, this family, to me, needs counseling. They cannot do that with Ray not getting paid and not having health care benefits. So can you explain to me what is the difference between these two, between three cops going on paid leave and Ray Wright's hitting his wife and getting terminated from his job?
I don't think they're comparable. I think a more reasonable comparison would be a guy who beats up his wife and doesn't lose his job because he's not in the public eye and his employer never finds out about it. Ray Rice, first of all, has probably already made more money than most of us will make in a lifetime. So, you know, I'm not crying crocodile tears for the guy, number one.
I'm not saying I'm crying crocodile tears, but I'm saying that you don't pay leave, and I'm just making a statement.
Yeah. No, I got it. I think what's going on with the police and people of color in this country is wrong. Let's set that aside, though. This does not have to do with police, and I don't know that it's white cops going after Ray Wright. It's not, you know, it's the league, the majority of the people playing in the league are not. Well, actually, I don't know. I don't know what the racial makeup of the NFL is. And probably management is largely white. So, you know, you may have a point there. But I don't think that this is a racial issue. I think this is people saying enough already with domestic violence. This, when you're a football player at that level in the National Football League, you're not just a football player. You're a star. You're a media figure. And you're a role model for children all across the United States. And
so are police officers. And so are police officers.
No, they're not. So they're not stars. They're not. You know.
But they're role models.
Well, maybe to some small extent, but you don't have a million people watching a cop every day. I mean, you know, this guy is Ray Rice was a star. I would think that if a movie star did the same thing, that the studios would stop hiring him.
I didn't say stop. I'm saying what I'm saying is, Tom, that when these things happen, the best thing for the family as a unit is not to cut this family off completely, because that's not what most people do.
Most employers,
let me say what I got to say there. You can finish. Yeah. I'm done. Most employers do not, if you're white, you can look at the statistics. Most employers do not cut you off. They give you paid leave, and they try to help you and your family work through it.
You're probably right.
They do it. That is not what
white
they do with Ray Rice. And you could look at the statistics and see if that is true. This family needs help. This family needs counseling.
I don't disagree, but they have more than enough money to buy it right now, Joyce.
They still going to need money to make the man getting cut off. You don't know what that man money looks like. You're cutting him off as of now.
Yeah, so he goes back to being just an average guy who's going to have to go out and look for an average job. After having made a pile of money, I don't think that's so terrible. Joyce, thank you for the call. I understand your point.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And ecowine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with me is the General Counsel and Director for the Free Enterprise Project over at the National Center for Public Policy Research, a conservative think tank. Nationalcenter.org is the website. Justin Danhoff is his name. Hey, Justin, welcome to the program.
It's good to talk with you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Did I accurately characterize National Center?
That's right. We're a conservative think tank, been around since 1982.
Okay, so you have some thoughts about free speech and hostile work environments. In fact, did you write this? Or?
Yes.
Okay, government may soon direct what private sector employees may say in the workplace. Doesn't the government already direct that? I mean, if I walk up to one of my employees and start calling them obscene and offensive names, they have the basis at law for arguing that I've created a hostile workplace and I'm an abusive boss and, for having some sort of an action against me, whether it's monetary damages or whatever. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Oh, I would help your employee in that situation, Tom. And what we're talking about is provocative speech that's not obscene, that doesn't cross the line into epithets, name-calling, things of the like. We're talking about, in this day and age, after the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman incident, after Michael Brown's shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, we have political pundits, we have politicians calling for frank discussions about race. And what we have highlighted is a North Carolina case that shows having a frank discussion about race is wrought with peril for the American worker because of hostile work environment laws that are very vague in breadth. So the arbiter, whether that be a judge, a jury, an administrative law judge, has wide latitude in deciding those types of cases.
You would want them to, wouldn't you?
Yes. Well,
I mean, what's reasonable? And what's reasonable is going to vary from circumstance to circumstance and person to person. But the case you have right here is where a supervisor, presumably a white supervisor, was reading a Facebook post, and it was basically the Drudge Report take on the killing of Trayvon Martin, which was, why isn't anybody talking about this white child who was shot by a black man? And, I mean, there are so many layers of BS in that. The fact of the matter is that we have systematic, across the United States, it was institutionalized at law for over 400 years in the United States and pre-United States, and now is, if not de jure, certainly de facto, the criminalization of blackness in this country. And this supervisor's reading this Facebook page saying, in the voice of the 13-month-old kid or whatever, saying, why isn't anybody protesting about me? Why are they all protesting about that black guy getting killed? If I'm African-American and my boss is talking like that, you know, I mean, this is a cue that either, A, this guy is totally clueless or ignorant, or, B, a racist. I would feel intimidated.
Well,
How can you defend that?
I don't think you can say that there's racial animus in just reading a post that's factual, right? There was no racial epithet.
It was not factual.
What wasn't factual in the post?
The post asserted to know the mind of a 13-month-old white kid.
It was from a perspective. There was no one in the room who thought the 13-year-old wrote this Facebook post. 13-month-old, I'm sorry, yeah. White baby wrote this Facebook post. It was obviously from an imagined
perspective. But it wasn't factual.
But what wasn't factual about the fact that there was 24/7 coverage of Trayvon Martin's death, and until you read that North Carolina case, had you ever heard of that 13-month-old baby being shot at point-blank range?
No, I hadn't, and I shouldn't. We don't have a systematic crisis in the United States of black people killing white babies. We do have a systematic crisis in the United States of white people killing black people, particularly white people in authority figures or wannabe authority figures like George Zimmerman or Officer Wilson in Missouri. These are real serious, not just public health issues, but criminal justice issues.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get at here is that talking, whether it's about race, whether it's about sex, whether it's about national origin, whether it's about sexual identification, all of these issues are wrought with peril if you talk about it at the water cooler. That's the larger point I want to make.
Exactly right.
If two black employees were talking about the pathetic athleticism of a white employee, that white employee may have a claim now. But let me give you another example.
How is
that
bad?
I'm saying it comes from all sides. So let me give you an example. Say two white middle-aged men are talking about their sons applying to college. Say that they do not like affirmative action because they think it disadvantages their son. And a black employee walks by and hears them say, well, black and Hispanics who are undeserving may get the seat that should go to my son.
Well, it's not a statement of fact. They would be deserving by definition if they got the seat they were deserving.
Through affirmative
action.
Is it is it okay to disagree in the public workplace about affirmative action?
I think your individual example is a straw man argument. Hey, let's find this the most innocuous or close to innocuous example that we can and put that forward. The law is not there to deal with the reason why judges have wide latitude is when you get into these gray areas.
Well, I think what the problem is who is it's viewpoint discrimination, right? That's what we're talking about here. So it's from my viewpoint.
No, it's not viewpoint discrimination.
Yes, it is.
It's discrimination against.
It's content and viewpoint both.
Against the words that you're missing here are against protected classes of people who are essentially minorities or people who have been disempowered, like women, who are not a minority but have those same functional protections because men have been so successful at oppressing them all these years. I mean, look at the percentage of women who are running major corporations in America, the number of women who are serving in our legislature.
Right, and President Obama's White House won't pay him an equal pay either.
Go after him. You have my blessing. Those are legitimate things. I mean, what's your remedy? What's your proposed remedy to this?
Get the government out, right?
In other words, just let people trash their employees.
No.
Let people intimidate their employees.
Absolutely not.
Then you want the government out.
Where there is real harassment, there needs to be remedies. Where there is just frank discussion about honest situations and the government wants to come in, let's talk about college speech codes. This is the area where I'm going to offer some advice out there. Those who have faced these lawsuits in the college speech code arena have fought back on First Amendment grounds and been able to kick a lot of these to the curb. Most times when employers are involved in these hostile work environment lawsuits, they just settle. They don't want the publicity. So the legal cases, the EEOC, since Eric Holder has taken over the Justice Department, since we have President Obama, we have a race-centric way of justice in this country.
Is this a conservative argument for, oh, my God, we got a black guy in the White House?
I spent the entire morning, Tom, going through the EEOC case log. There is not one instance since 2008, since President Obama came over, where a white employee was successful in a hostile work environment suit against superiors who were minorities. Before that, we had lawsuits coming from every angle, from Asians, from Hispanics, from blacks. But now we don't have anything like that anymore. I think that those who are looking through a racial spectrum are doing so with a reason, and I think that's very unfortunate.
Well, assuming that what you're saying is true, and I have no knowledge of this, so I can't back up that assertion, does that not mean that the George W. Bush administration and all the previous white presidents before were largely ignoring issues that this president and this attorney general have decided to address? And
no,
again, what's your problem?
There was plenty of lawsuits of blacks being oppressed in the workplace before. It wasn't.
So if your solution,
it was now, it's solely that.
Is your solution a solution at law?
It's policy and law.
So,
right?
So basically, you're telling. I want
all races of folks, I want all genders to be able to have frank discussions at the workplace that involve honesty. I don't want one class to be separated because they happen to be white.
But if I'm white and in a management position with somebody who's not white, there's a power imbalance to begin with, A, management position, and B, in our society, just, you know, white privilege. I mean,
I dismiss that out of hand. When you're talking,
you don't think white privilege exists?
I dismiss that out of hand.
That's incredible.
When we have our,
what country do you
live
in?
We have more women going to law school than men, don't we?
What does that have to do with white privilege?
We're talking about gender disparity, race disparity. We have black and Hispanic students entering colleges that are way beyond the spectrum of their ability because they were given so many extra points through affirmative action.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay. Justin Danhoff, General Counsel and Director of the Free Enterprise Project, the National Center for Public Policy Research, nationalcenter.org. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you so much, Tom.
We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And that's interesting. Let's see here. Patricia, watching Free Speech TV in Portage, Wisconsin. Hey, Patricia, you wanted to get back to gun violence?
I do. I want to talk about where most of the gun violence is. It's not even recognized, is on our wildlife. And let me just read you two things coming out of our scientists and the United Nations. Accelerating biodiversity loss is a fundamental threat to the survival of humans. on this planet. Scientists say the entire ecosystem is catastrophically approaching a tipping point where we can have all sorts of sudden changes like we're going to have with global climate change. But scientists say that biodiversity loss, I was listening to your talk with Paul Stamets about, he said something like 300,000 species are going extinct a year.
Right.
We have to have, I'm calling to ask you to have a segment for the other 99.9% of the species on this planet that weave it together for human survival.
Right.
I
would make an argument, Patricia, that we don't always need to frame things in the context of human survival. It's a frame that sells well to humans to say, you know, if we continue destroying our biosphere, we're going to ultimately destroy ourselves. But, there was a time in human, in the evolution of human beings that appears to have lasted somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 years up until basically the agricultural revolution when the world was viewed as sacred.
Right. And, you know, I'm used to framing it in human terms because it's humans that have control of the law. And
right.
If we don't strengthen our laws, one of the things that really is fundamental is that state agencies that manage wildlife are funded primarily by killing licenses. So when instead of general public funds, we need to reform that because our state agencies are just killing businesses for the few, and they are now morphed in from hunting to thrill killing, head hunting, trapping out. In Wisconsin, where I live, they have access to all of our public lands, every bit of it, including state parks, right. Trappers, 7 months of the year, right through April when babies are born, to take out as much.
We're talking about animals here.
Get.
We're talking about non-human species, right?
Non-human species, but they weave the world together for everybody. We are destroying our natural predators. We are destroying large mammals on this planet.
I agree.
Amphibians, pollinators. But I'm asking you to do a segment on it regularly because we are so homocentric. We are so focused on our own selves that we have let this go. We have outdoors pages that are killing advocacy in the media with no response.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to stop propagandizing this glorification of killing to children.
Right.
You know, that we have a recruitment going on in Wisconsin. We have a 12-member recruitment committee legislated to get more kids and women into killing wildlife. It is a disaster.
Right. Patricia, I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. That was interesting. No such thing as white privilege. I really should have, and next time I'm going to. This is the second time I've had a conservative in the studio booked for one block, and I've said goodbye at the end, and there was so much more of a conversation we could have had. This guy starts asserting there's no such thing as white privilege. I should have invited Justin to stick around, defend that assertion, and even take calls from you, and in the future I will. Ray in Stockton, California, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, you want to talk about Richard? Excuse me, Richard. You want to talk about Ray Rice?
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for putting me on. Yeah, I'm just calling. Most people think that Rice is going to lose that $35 million. Well, he's been paid up front from the Ravens $25 million,
right?
And they can't get that back.
Right.
That just came over the news.
Right.
So these guys that are calling in there saying that, you know, you can't pay for insurance. Well, I think $25 million.
$25 million is a lot more than I've ever seen in my whole entire life. It's a mind-boggling
right.
amount of money. I would take the money and run, even if I was 30 years old.
Yeah, and they said that they can't get it back from him. It's in the contract. So.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not crying crocodile tears for him. Richard, thank you for the call. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Tom. I know that you and your audience have a lot of respect for history and development in our country. And so I would like to talk about our movement toward a police state. First of all, I'd like to introduce some caveats. The Indians and the African Americans were excluded, of course, from what I'm going to talk about. And there was corruption, such as was reported in the book Slavery by Another Name by Douglas Blackmun. And if people haven't read that book, they will not understand race in America today until they do. I would like to talk about the fact that in the beginning, we had a justice of the peace, and the officers of the court were peace officers. And their mission was to keep the peace. If you and I had a disagreement, and it was likely to devolve into some kind of violence, we would be taken to court, and somehow the justice of the peace would work it out.
Right. Bob, can I ask you to summarize, get to your point? We've been on for 3.5 minutes, and I'm not sure exactly what you're saying, and I got a dozen other people who want to get in here. What's your point?
Well, we evolved from that to having policemen as officers of the court after we became urbanized, and their mission was to keep things safe.
Right.
Today, we have law enforcement officers, which makes everyone a suspect because law enforcement officers are a top-down justice system, whereas justice of the peace was a bottom-up system of justice.
It's an interesting analysis, Bob. I read historical fiction, and you know, old, not historical fiction. I read novels that were written in the 19th century, late 19th and early 20th century, and even the like you know, Dashiell Hammett or Raymond Chandler, who were writing in the 20s, 30s, and 40s in the United States. And, you know, routinely talking about the police coming into particularly communities of color and brutalizing people. I think that in some ways things have gotten better, in some ways they've gotten worse. But the police, I don't think, were ever a benevolent institution. They've always been an institution of the uber culture. And women were excluded from that, as well as people of color and Native Americans. But your point is well taken, Bob. Thank you for calling and making it. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, you wanted to talk about Ray Rice?
Yeah, and let me preface this that my first job out of college was working at a domestic abuse shelter.
Right.
We are having the wrong conversation. The NFL's response doesn't matter. We need to be talking about the police officer arrested the woman and charged her with the same crime as Ray Rice.
Right.
We need to be talking about why did the prosecution agree to a plea deal in which he received no jail time. Those are the important conversations, and all anybody is talking about is the NFL's response.
Right, so we should be talking rather than about his employer's response to what happened. The law enforcement, our criminal justice system's response to what happened.
Absolutely.
I would submit to you, Margie, that this is one of those areas I think where in some ways celebrity trumps race. And I realize even wealthy and famous African Americans still have, you know, many of the same struggles and crises that non-wealthy and famous African Americans have, but. Had this just been Joe Schmo, regardless of race, who punched his wife unconscious in an elevator, I suspect it wouldn't have been treated. Well, who knows? Actually, I don't know. I'm out of my depth here on this. I haven't been in the criminal justice system, so I don't know. Margie, you raise a really, really important point, though. We should be talking about the criminal justice system and their failures, as well as the NFL. Thank you very much. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if you have some thoughts on what our guest had to say about hostile work environments and there being no such thing as white privilege, give us a shout. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. In the next hour, we're going to get into a food fight. That should be entertaining. But for right now, Michael in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, you wanted to talk, you wanted to respond to a caller we had yesterday who was, I think even actually it was a guest, who was saying that men are becoming feminized and it's going to be a disaster for society?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to, I heard kind of his comment, one of your callers, I think his name is Michael, which kind of rang a bell with me. That's why I kind of latched onto that call. He was talking about the feminization of black men and how, you know, out in society, what you see is, you know, today in particular, you know, the images of black men being, you know, sports figures, and then, you know, you go into the entertainment industry and whatnot, this overwhelming machismo, I guess that you could call it, that's outwardly portrayed. And the guy was talking about roles, and he said, you know, we have roles in society. And it struck me that the roles that women have been given have been given to them by men.
Right.
For how many millennia? I read a book by Robert Gribbs called The Greek Mythology, but he goes into explaining about early Greek culture and the cultures that, I guess, you know, brought about a lot of what, you know, early Greek society did. They were matriarchal societies.
Yeah, early Greek culture was much more egalitarian than late Greek culture, which was totally male-dominated.
Absolutely. And, you know, you were talking about, you know, the Native American, the moieties of the Native American nations here, the women sat in council,
right.
And, you know, the women made policy,
yep.
And the women made law.
Yep.
And that was for probably millennia also,
right.
You know, women in Mayan society.
And it was sustainable.
Although there was not equality, you could say equality in terms of economics or anything, in terms of spirituality and politics, they were.
Yeah, yeah. And it was sustainable. I think that's one of the most important carryaways from that. Michael, thank you. Excellent points all. Tim in Hayward, California. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the call. And I want to thank you for the time you spend informing the rest of us. It's greatly appreciated. I've been listening to your thing on the police over the last couple of 3 weeks, and just wanted to point out, I'm in the Bay Area, and I did some checking on our police departments, and most of our police departments have 24 to 27 weeks of training, which kind of leads me to believe that we're partly responsible for the problem that's out there. I don't think you can, in 6 months, train an officer in all the things that they need to do. And they're going out there, I've spoke to some of them, and they're going out there scared to death.
Yeah.
That, you know, that they're going to be shot. So I think a lot of our problems are we've got officers on the streets that aren't trained.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think that, you know, mentorship programs within police departments would be a good idea, too. So it takes, so basically you have to do a year or 2 years or 3 years of an apprenticeship before you're even, you know, a full-time real life, you know, before you, you know, and the unions could administer this stuff. I mean, you know, they used to do this in tool and die shops. I think they still do, you know, on construction sites for the electricians and the roofers and everybody, you know, you have apprenticeship programs. I'm with you, Tim. Excellent point. Thank you for the call. Eric in Madison, Wisconsin, listening to the mic. Hey, Eric, you wanted to talk about domestic violence?
Yeah. Long time listener, first time caller.
Thank you.
Before I make my point about what happened, to me, I want if you ever want to see a really good movie on domestic violence, there's one from New Zealand called Once Were Warriors. It's one of the most it's an incredible movie.
Is it about the Maori?
It's a great movie. It's probably one of my best movies of all times. I want to, and I'll try to make this real quick because I know you have limited time, about what happened to me. I had an ex-girlfriend. We were together about 7 years. We still see each other as friends because we have a child together. About a couple years ago, we had gotten in an argument, and she had attacked me. and grabbed me by my bicep and was squeezing extremely hard with her nails digging into my arms. And she was shaking and screaming, and I'm screaming at her, get off me, get off me. And when I would try to pull away and get out the door, it would cause her fingernails and her nails to dig in deeper into my arms. And I kept screaming, get off me, get off me. And her son is like, get off of him. And she wouldn't get off me. So I slapped her not that hard in the face to get her to stop. And she's like, I'm calling the cops, I'm calling the cops. So I got out the door. She called the cops. We both said what happened. I get arrested, and then we get to the car, and I said, well, you know, I couldn't get her to let go. And the police officer explained to me, he's like, well, you know, you're a man, and essentially, you know, our policy is that if a man is getting hit by a woman, unless he's being attacked with a weapon, he's essentially has to eat the pain and continue to try to get away, and then he has to call the police. And then, you know, I wound up getting the charge dropped from a misdemeanor battery to a disorderly conduct that was a non-domestic. My attorney had said, you know, essentially with a lot of, and I think domestic violence is a problem, but to say that men don't get the short end of the stick, a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of political pressure to prosecute, you know, men for domestic violence. Oftentimes, the presumption of it, the system can be slanted against men at times. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
No, I've heard all the stories, not all of them, but I mean, I've read these things, and there's no shortage of men who you know, email me or post on our message boards or over on our website about these kind of things. I think the trend, as a consequence of what you're describing. Where the police officer basically is assigning themselves the job of being judge or jury, you know, before the fact and only arresting one party. This may have something to do with why both Ray Rice and his wife were arrested, that increasingly police departments are saying, okay, you guys are fighting, you are both in violation of the law, or at least I can't make up, you know, I'm not the judge here. So they arrest both parties, take it into court, and let the judge or the judge and the jury sort it out. And that seems to me like a much more common sense approach to it, although it runs the risk of people who are actually genuine victims being arrested and subjected to the criminal justice system.
And of course, he's a man of also, too, of significant status. So he tends to have – the police might give him a little bit more leeway than a person.
On the one hand, yeah, he's a man of considerable status. On the other hand, he's a man of considerable physical force, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that – it just on its face indicates that the power relationship between him and his wife was not symmetrical.
Absolutely.
So
she was attacking him, and let's say she was really beaten on him, and let's say he pushed her, and she went back against the elevator and like hurt her shoulder a little bit. Then you could say, yeah, he's stronger than her, but the force was.
She did not bring a baseball bat into that elevator. I mean, she was using her hands, or just her body. I mean, it was just it was an asymmetrical thing. Eric, interesting point. Thanks a lot for bringing it up. Anthony in Kings Park, New York. Hey, Anthony. White privilege?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I wanted to go back to the point of white advantage in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
I myself actually encountered something a little bit different, straight advantage in the workplace.
Oh, yeah.
I myself am a white male. I was working in a very conservative educational institution. I was treated like gold. I was kind of, you know, one of the white men's club that they had. Management treated me greatly. About a year or two in, once it became known that I was actually a gay man, I was all of a sudden ostracized by management and treated as the lowest of the low. And it was unbelievable how they just kind of disowned me, even though I was a faithful employee who, until they knew about my sexual orientation, they thought I was one of them.
Right.
So I think that there's also a straight advantage in these conservative pockets in certain places in the country that still exists.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, you're absolutely right. And that's why we need to be rewriting the protected categories laws to include LGBT people.
Absolutely.
And in most places they don't, and the federal law is you know, not there yet, and we have a long way to go on that. Anthony, thank you for sharing your story with us. It's compelling. I appreciate it. Mike in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to bring up the thing about restaurant wages.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the early 80s, I managed several restaurants. Okay? And I have actually fired 8 or 9 people because I've seen what they did. If a customer PO'd them off,
yeah,
what they would do with the food.
Yeah.
And I would
Yeah, we've all heard the horror stories, you know.
Yes, it is true. There's no two ways about it. And if I fired them, they could walk across the street and get another job if they had any kind of experience.
Right.
And at another point where I almost lost my job back in the early 80s. I think the minimum wage was $3.25 or somewhere in that range, $3.60 maybe. I told our waitresses that all they had to do was claim the amount they served on their tips to reach the minimum wage law, and then they could keep the rest. And
I think that's illegal.
Well, I know that now, but once that got around to the company, I got demoted.
Yeah, I understand. I evolved because it's illegal. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting stories. Interesting stories. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls and Bob Nay with the Talk Radio News Service in a few minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More specifically, about 4 minutes. Stick around. Welcome back. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor.
Sir.
Suppose a nerd, a hacker, decided to hack that Swiss bank that contains the names of 22,000 convicted Americans from, who didn't want to pay their taxes.
I don't think it was a hacker. I think it was an employee of USB who is now in prison in the United States for revealing confidential trade information, isn't it?
Well, you just answered my question, because I was thinking we can get the names of those people and then approach them and ask them if they would want to voluntarily make a contribution.
Right.
So that $50 million that we need to get that voter's registration going on. But I guess you've answered my question. It would be a criminal referral.
Yeah, and this is the bizarre thing is that, you know, USB is paying fines. This is the United Bank of Switzerland. They're paying fines for this and all this kind of stuff, and there's this big debate about whether or not they should open their records to the IRS, and at one point it looked like they were, and then it looked like they weren't. I'm not sure exactly where it stands right now. But the guy who was an American employee, he was an American who was working in Switzerland for UBS, or USB, UBS, I guess it is, he revealed this information to U.S. authorities. He was a whistleblower, and he is now in prison in the United States. And
now, that don't make no sense.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, the banksters did not go to jail. Instead, they prosecuted this guy and got a conviction against him for being the whistleblower. So it's pretty grim. Morris, thanks for the call. Good idea. We do need to get the voter registration thing going. I'm with you on that. Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Anything goes summer. Just a quick observation. Isn't it amazing that you use the term heroin pertaining to a woman being abused in video games, which I agree, they are abused. Isn't it wild that if a man is a hero, then a female is a heroine? And I just find it wild that the most powerful drug on the planet is also called heroin. What are your thoughts? Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I'm not sure that there's a causal relationship there. Heroin was the brand name that Bayer came up with. Bayer, we call it Bayer here in the United States. In Germany, they call it Bayer, which is a German company. And Bayer came up with heroin as the brand name for their new cough reliever for children. And heroin was marketed as a cough syrup in 1915 or 1918, in the early 20th century. It was marketed as a cough syrup for children. I mean, codeine was being sold over the counter as a cough syrup when I was a kid. One of my best friends, his dad, had this big bottle of codeine sitting on his bedroom dresser. I think he was addicted to it, And but this was heroin is even more potent. And, you know, it didn't work out so well for Bayer. They discovered fairly quickly that it did a great job of doing away with babies' coughs. But when adults started using this stuff, it was presenting a serious addiction problem. But I think that the heroin word came not from heroin, H-E-R-O-I-N-E, as in the female hero of a story, but probably from something German or Germanic. Although I could be wrong. I mean, who knows? But it's an interesting, Michael. The etymology of words is one of my private fascinations. So now you got me going. I'm going to have to look this up. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back with Bob Ney. Stick around. It's Ney Day. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with, it's Ney Day. Let's check in with Bob Ney of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Bob Ney, of course, the author of the brilliant book about how Washington really works. It's called Sideswiped, and if you haven't read it, you should. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Now, I do know the drug heroin got its name from the Greek word for hero.
Really?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Shane just Googled it, and he said there's no evidence of that and that it was a Germanic word.
From heroes. That's what I've been told, and that was at the rehab center, so I don't know.
Huh.
Maybe they made that up.
Maybe they would know, or maybe it was, Vanishing Hitchhiker story. Fascinating. Okay, so what's going on in the world, Bob?
This is meeting day on Capitol Hill. Some bizarre, some not so bizarre and important days. 3:15, the top four, the big four, which would be Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, of course, the Democrats and Republicans of the Senate, and then John Boehner, the Republican Speaker, and Nancy Pelosi, the Minority Leader, Democratic, will all be going to the White House and meeting in a closed door, no press meeting, of course.
It's in about an hour and a half.
I'm sorry, what's that?
About an hour and a half from now.
But yes, and they'll be there about 3:15. Meanwhile, of course, the president at 9, some tomorrow night, will be doing prime time live with the nation, and some of that will be a result of what's going to come out of the office meeting, I think, today in the Oval Office with the leaders. The entire plan for what he's going to do with ISIS, the president, Tom, at this point in time is not totally in place. I think most of it is in place. He's probably going to have a sounding board with the leaders, and of course, the two Republicans will come out and attack him, afterwards.
Do you think?
Psychic, too. Yes, I'm pretty up on politics, not to predict that one.
Yeah.
And, so they won't, be happy. Of course, the president could make them all pass out if he simply said, how about a vote in the House and Senate?
Right. Right.
Then they would all be taken out on an ambulance stretcher because they seriously do not want to vote. Boehner has such problems in his conference if they have a vote that it's just...
they would just faint away.
Yeah, right over the top. Now, the big meeting of the day that is of no significance, but it is in the realm of the bizarre, who is headed to Capitol Hill across the street at the Republican National Committee. All of the House Republicans are going to be entertained by no other than Dick Cheney.
Oh, jeez.
Yes. He is being brought out of retirement. Maybe he's going to tell them where weapons of mass destruction are.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help but throw that in.
Dick
Cheney has actually been called to talk to the Republicans for a pep rally.
Let's talk to Darth Vader and get all excited.
I mean, it's really, seriously, unbelievable policy. After Iraq and weapons of mass destruction and what it all led to, which is part of the problem we have now, I really found it amazing that Dick Cheney will be addressing House Republicans. They would have him there in such an obvious time, when they're talking about how to deal with Iraq.
Right.
But he will be over there.
He's the one who broke it.
So,
it's amazing.
He's the one that steered the war and the one that promoted it and pushed it. But they feel they're going to get some type of form of wisdom from him, I guess, today.
Right.
And then, the president will lay his groundwork again today, and he's trying to reach out to the congressional leaders, and then his address will be on the circuit, on the docket for tomorrow.
He keeps doing that. He has been doing that for 6 years, and I'm starting to feel like I'm reading an old Charles Schulz peanut strip where Lucy's holding the football for Charlie Brown.
Yes.
I mean, he keeps reaching out to them, and they keep pulling the football away.
And they will, because they're what they're doing in a very serious manner, and it's okay to have differences of opinion. You know that, and I know that. We're all big boys and girls in politics. But on something of this nature, of something so serious to the, the future of America, usually a president will get some benefit of the doubt. And I mean, just, look at George Bush and some of the things that he did. But in this case, there is nothing that the president will be able to do correctly. The only thing that can happen tomorrow is his appeal is directly to the American people, because he is not going to get any type of a break from Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
Particularly on the Republican side, of course.
Yep.
Elections are coming.
No, it's all about politics right now.
And they're starting to use this already. If you look at the races, in the, especially the Senate side, and Al Franken, they're utilizing a couple of the kids, and they're trying to tie them to terror and tie it to Al Franken. So if you look, I'm confident in the next few days there's going to be a whole barrage of new ads paid for by the super PACs that will be casting, everybody with the weak on terror aspect because, quote, the president didn't have a strategy.
Right.
They criticized him for it. He'll have a strategy today and tomorrow, but that will be, in their opinion, too late.
Yeah.
That will be the muddle that will come out of it.
I think you're right.
And then speaking of muddle, the immigration policy, there's a lot of speculation what that's going to be. And, of course, it's going to be after the election, and it still will be used in the elections. I think the Republicans themselves, although they will complain about it, would have some form of relief that something's not out there that they actually have to take a solid opinion on. And they're afraid of completely losing what they've lost more from the Hispanic base in the country. So even though they, have great problems with the president not coming out with his position now, I think in a sense there's a relief that they don't have to weigh in on it at this point in time. I really do.
Yeah.
And then one other matter I want to talk about, at least bring to the attention, is Ferguson, because the Justice Department will be in there. And the Ferguson City Council, however, has finally began to, I guess you'd say, take some steps on their own to do something, about the problem out there. They're trying to take some type of note of a citizens' review board, provide guidance for the police department. And this is most likely happening because they know the Justice Department is in there, and there's going to be some type of look deep and some type of finding by the Justice Department, which they're, I think, trying to do probably their part to at least stave off some of the rulings that will come out of justice on it.
Yeah.
On a positive note, Tom, the new Secretary Robert McDonald of the VA is making some good gains on Capitol Hill and some at least support for what he's trying to do in the approach of the veterans.
Great. Great. Bob, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, author of Sideswipe. Check it out. Just an absolutely great book. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And ecowine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with me Right now is Professor Ben Agger. He's a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Theory at the University of Texas at Arlington, UTA.edu, of course, the website for the university. And he wrote a piece that Alternet renamed with the title, The Epic Food Fight Between Corporations and Americans Who Want to Eat Healthy, which raised in my mind the questions, what is Marxism and what is food capitalism? Professor Agger, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I'm good. How about you?
Good. Good. Thanks for joining us.
I now realize which Tom Hartman you are. You're the Tom Hartman who helped me view myself as a hunter-gatherer and a hyper-focuser, not someone who is a bad boy who fidgeted in school.
Maybe you and I are both.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. Well taken.
Anyhow, I don't think either one of us were bad boys, although, fidgeting.
Well, bad is now good. So
my second grade teacher, Mrs. Clark, she used to say, Tom, an empty wagon always rattles, and even a fish wouldn't get caught if it kept its mouth shut.
Well, it stuck with you. You remembered her.
Yeah, she did. She was one of the best teachers I had, actually. She took me for who I was, even though she was constantly trying to shut me up.
Okay,
in your piece,
talk to you about food capitalism.
Let's get back to food capitalism. In your piece, talks about your experience with high fat and low carb diets, and all this kind of stuff, and there's now this article that the New York Times published, and this recent study turns out it really wasn't that much of a study, and that most of the people on the high carb diet who saw increases in inflammation and weight were actually eating massive amounts of sugar and candies. It was just a horribly done study. But, you know, setting that aside for the moment, in talking about this, there were a couple of things that I thought were really interesting, and I think the essence of it is in this sentence. You write, as a Marxist, I find it is easy to see that capitalism makes us sick with a standard Western diet of processed foods and abundant sweeteners for profit, and then heals us with various body industries also for profit.
Yeah, I wrote a book a couple of years ago simply entitled Body Problems, and the subtitle is Running and Living Long in a Fast Food Society, where I tried to advance that argument, which is basically an empirical argument.
Now, go for it.
I want to hasten to add that Karl Marx, the great bearded one himself, extolled the virtues of capitalism, because it's not until we get capitalist mass production, according to Marx, now including the mass production of food, that we ever begin to deal with hunger and also deprivation of a variety of kinds. So if you read the Communist Manifesto carefully, he would have heaped praise on Henry Ford and his era of mass production had he lived long enough.
Well, it's been probably 10 years, but the Communist Manifesto is fairly short. I've read that several times.
Indeed.
I only read Capital once, and I didn't read all of the book. I had to read it for coursework, but I don't recall that reference. I'm guessing it's probably there, but
it's throughout the oeuvre of Marx, the corpus of Marx's work.
Okay.
So the question is, what happens to food when food is sold for profit?
Right.
And the basic premise, which I think is relatively uncontroversial, is that food and diet and bodies themselves are both political and economic. Leaving Marx aside, second wave feminism noticed this as early as the 1960s. And then I also reference what's a really foundational work by Susie Orbach from the 70s, coming out of so-called second-wave feminism, entitled Fat is a Feminist Issue.
Right.
So there are different ways of coming at this. After all of us eat, and many of us have problematic relationships to food.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument simply is you can't take that out of political and economic context, especially when you look at the power of a media culture that, in a sense, makes people hungry, especially young people, and makes potentially problematic diets and food nearly irresistible.
So
this has given birth to, the term I use is a whole configuration of research, of studies, including theory, but a lot of empirical studies of the kind referenced in the New York Times piece that I would loosely call critical food and exercise studies. And it's out of that context that I talk about the, quote, food fight between, if you will, veganism, which is anti-meat and anti-dairy to some extent,
right,
and both Atkins and Paleo, who identify not meat as the culprit, but rather carbohydrates.
Right.
And that's the point of departure. But I'm situating this in an earlier and larger context in which food can be viewed both as political and economic, as well as, of course, physiological.
Right, right. So, you know, if we have an analysis that suggests that, I mean, we have this obesity epidemic in the United States. You've got, for years and years, we have not been at the top of longevity in the world, and arguably much of that comes from our processed food industries. How do we go from an analysis that shows that, you know, there are some areas where capitalism, or at least unconstrained capitalism, or capitalism that has captured government agencies to its benefit, where it's getting huge subsidies and things like that, that this is not a healthy economically, politically, practically speaking, from society's point of view, this is not healthy. And of course, it's not healthy because it's not physically healthy for us. How do we go from an analysis to actually policy steps?
Well,
changing
policy
things.
Steps and also individual level steps.
Yeah.
I mean, let's perform this thought experiment. Every American goes vegan, again, a term with which I'm uncomfortable, but basically moves away from the Western diet.
Right.
Every American does this by choice, perhaps prompted by policy recommendations. Simultaneously, every American, to the extent possible, gets sort of baseline 30 minutes of endurance exercise, whether it's elliptical or swimming or running or walking, 6 or 7 days a week. I predict, that would dramatically reduce the aggregate healthcare budget by many billions, and I'm certainly not alone.
Well, Finland has done this. I mean, Finland, saw that they had a heart disease and cancer problem some decades ago, and instituted a program nationwide to promote less meat in the diet, shall we say. They weren't actually promoting veganism, but less meat in the diet. Norway picked this up, and the army in Norway has what they call Meatless Mondays. They eat no meat on Mondays. In part, it was because of public health. In part, it was because meat is so intensive, so carbon intensive. You know, a pound of meat represents, you know, 50 or 100 pounds of vegetables in terms of the carbon footprint.
Yes. And also, I think Scandinavians, by and large, get more exercise than Americans of the aerobic kind.
Yeah, I think this is true all across Europe, by the way, having lived there for a year.
Epidemiological or large-scale health data certainly support the contention of sort of vegan-oriented doctors and other clinicians at the individual level who see remarkable, like the famous Esselstyn, Dr. Esselstyn from the Cleveland Clinic, reversals of heart disease by way of plant-based diets.
Yeah, this is the diet that Bill Clinton is on. There's an amazing website called nutritionfacts.org that is run by a physician who just is constantly laying out the latest medical research that, you know, supports this hypothesis that particularly for anybody over 40, not being a vegan is almost a crazy thing.
That's really interesting, and it was also mainstreamed in the by now infamous CNN piece done by Dr. Gupta, Sanjay Gupta, on such issues and focusing especially on Clinton and how he dealt with the aftermath of bypass surgery by forswearing meat and dairy.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm frankly of the opinion that dairy is probably far worse for us than meat, which is something that a lot of vegetarians don't want to hear. But, you know, I'm with the Japanese. What is cheese? It's the curdled, rotted secretion of a giant mammary gland, you know, on a larger mammal than us. I mean, you know, really?
Well,
we're out of time, Professor.
And yet, many believe it's the only way to get calcium.
Yeah. Which is nonsense. There's plenty of calcium in vegetables. Professor Ben Agar, I'm sorry we're out of time, sir, but thank you for being with us today.
Tom, call me anytime.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read his work over at UTA.org and also on Alternet. It's called The Epic Food Fight Between Corporations and Americans Who Want to Eat Healthy. We'll be back. We've covered so much territory here today. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Oh, Tom, yeah, I want to give the fast food workers some advice when they're organizing.
Okay.
The first and foremost is vote. Vote for your local politicians, your federal and state politicians.
Right, and you've got an election coming up in a few months where you have just that opportunity.
Right, and the second piece of advice that's so very important is vote for your union leaders.
Right.
I was a union steward. I was in charge of a barn of 135 workers. We would advocate on their behalf if they got in trouble or disciplinary problems. We were involved in negotiating for raises, pay increases, and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So I know the inner workings. And what used to tick me off the most was the guy that complained the most about the union not doing enough for him. He was the one that didn't vote. And here's the irony. In order to vote, they mailed you a ballot in the mail. You take it out of your mailbox, sit down at your kitchen table, and check off the box the guy you want. They even sent a self-addressed stamped envelope to mail it back.
Wow.
And the first thing I would ask somebody who was railing about the union was, did you vote? And the answer, 9 times out of 10, was no, I didn't. Why not? You've got to participate. If you want a good union and a strong union that advocates for the people, you have to vote. You have to know their positions, what they believe in, and you have to vote. Otherwise, the company's going to buy them out.
Corky, I think this younger generation of people who are coming up now, who are leading these fast food movements and these strikes, I think they're getting it. And it's that kind of middle generation, the remnants of the Reagan era, who are so lost because they got indoctrinated by Reagan and the media in the 80s and 90s. And now they're, you know, the world doesn't comport with their worldview and they're not sure what to do. Corky, thanks so much for the call. Well said. Words of wisdom. John in Sholo, Arizona. You want to talk about the right to carry a handgun?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
First, yeah, I will not lose my train of thought. I wanted to thank you back in the days when you're on overnight on the radio.
Uh-huh.
You'd keep me on for an hour. You'd pick my brain. I felt like I was defending my dissertations every time.
Well, thank you.
Kept me young.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, John, we've got about 50 seconds here. Fire away.
You got it. Right away. Do you remember the Luby's Cafeteria Massacre in 1991 in Killeen, Texas?
Vaguely.
People, 22 dead, 20 wounded.
Right.
The people who were debriefed left their pistols in the car and wished they had them with them.
Right.
I've had to do everything in my life to survive, and I've never, ever pointed a weapon at anyone, but I've always had one in my pocket. I have been a bodyguard. I defend women. People weaker than I am.
But events like that, John, are less likely than getting struck by lightning. Should we all walk around with a lightning rod?
I understand. But I know it comes down to the individual.
Well, the fact of the matter is if we all walked around with a lightning rod, we might have fewer lightning deaths in the United States. But I don't think that walking around with a gun is going to reduce deaths. In fact, all the evidence shows that it increases accidental deaths.
Automobiles kill 4 people an hour. Homicides kill 3 people an hour. In the United States.
What kills 4 people an hour?
Automobiles.
4 people an hour. I don't know, 50,000 people. Yeah, may well be. Okay, John, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. So now they're calling for Roger Goodell's head on a stake. You know? Hey. Oh, man. Bob in Trabuco Canyon, California. You wanted to weigh in on the Ray Rice story and how Fox so-called news responded to it?
Yeah, but first I want to talk about the guy who wanted to play it down as 2 drunk people in an elevator. I think he had Rice on his fantasy football team.
He had what?
Back on there.
Say that again?
Rice on his football team roster.
Ah. You
know, running quarterbacks.
Yeah, okay.
But as far as the Fox response, you know, Kilmeade's comment was bad. Ducey's was bad, but just as bad was Hasselbeck's response, shuffling through it all.
You got the clip? Oh, here it is. For people who don't know what you're talking about, here's the clip.
I think the message is take the stairs.
The message is when you're in an elevator, there's a camera.
Yeah.
And there's a camera right now on Heather Nauert, who's got the headline.
Hi.
There we go. What's the carry away message from you?
Hasselbeck. Kind of chuckling through it all.
Yeah, she didn't say a word, did she?
She didn't say a word. So, and your screener thought it might have been a nervous chuckle, so which is just as bad. She didn't feel comfortable enough to say something about
right.
it. Right. I mean, you can tell.
Well, Fox so-called news came out today, and I saw the headline. I haven't read the story, but apparently they apologized or they said, you know, we didn't mean to minimize this. We take domestic violence seriously. But you know, Ducey and Kilmeade, you know, these guys are just, you know, they're not the brightest bulbs in the tree. And I, you know, that's all I can say about it. Bob, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Gary in Greenwood, Indiana. Hey, Gary.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I'm calling about a festival that I was at in northern Kentucky over the weekend in a town of about 4,000.
Right.
And I happened to, through a friend, talk to the police chief, and he goes to his cruiser, opens the trunk, and pulls out an M16.
Wow.
And I said, well, where'd you get it from? And he said, I got this and 29 more assault rifles from the U.S. military.
Right.
And keep in mind, this is like maybe a police department of maybe half a dozen people.
Right.
And I said, well, what'd you have to give for it? And he says, well, I just had to pay the shipping. He paid $400 for 30 assault rifles for a town of 4,000 people.
It's incredible. Louise and I were watching a cop show last night. I won't identify it. And, you know, just good, dumb, fun, fall asleep. And I think in this case, it was the FBI. They showed up to arrest a guy. They had the house surrounded. The guy was in the house. And they're all carrying these assault weapons. And I'm like, you're carrying weapons of war? And then they smash in the door and they throw flashbangs in and tear gas in and they go in and get the guy and take him out. And I'm like, whatever happened to come on out with your hands up? And
exactly.
And these TV shows are training our cops how to behave. And it's just bizarre. Gary, thank you for the call. Susan in Algona, Iowa. Hey, Susan, you wanted to talk about white privilege?
Yeah.
Go for it.
I was like that guy that you interviewed earlier. I didn't believe that white privilege existed either until yesterday when you were talking about your experience with the cop.
Right.
Because I'm like, when they told me what white privilege was, they said it's I have a greater advantage for education and progression in life because I'm white. And I'm like, to me, that's absolutely not true. But I do have opportunities because people will talk to me because I'm white. People will do things differently for me because I'm white. But I didn't understand that because I was under the impression it's money.
Yeah.
Privilege means money.
Yeah. Well, the story I told was being 16 years old in Lansing, Michigan, and getting picked up by a police officer while I was hitchhiking, and I had some pot in my pocket, and he didn't arrest me, I was in a largely black neighborhood, and he just wanted to make sure I was okay, which is really weird, because if I had been a black guy hitchhiking in the same place with pot in his pocket, and in fact, a friend of mine, Sam Witherspoon, who lived in that neighborhood, spent probably a third of his life in prison, and it was all drug related. And it's just, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. I was white. I didn't get busted. Sam was black. He got busted repeatedly. And, you know, I saw this with my own eyes. And in fact, his wife, who was white, got busted because she was married to him. She was with him. And she got busted a couple of times. And it was just, you're absolutely right, Susan. And this is the thing that white people don't get, is that white privilege is like an invisible knapsack we're born with. You know, with guidebooks and secret codes and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, people of color understand white privilege. White people don't. Thank you for the revelation, Susan, and for the call. Andy in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Andy, thanks for calling in. What's up? Domestic violence laws?
First off, hello?
Yeah, hello. You're on the air, Andy.
Okay, thank you. First off, I would like to thank you for having Doug Giles on. I think it's a very noble cause. I would like to remind everybody, though, that Doug Giles' daughter was also the person who instigated the whole Acorn thing, which is why he didn't want to talk about his family. The whole Acorn was a good operation, and his daughter was the one who was videotaping the whole prostitute / whatever story
yeah.
they were trying to do.
Andy, I can't corroborate that, and you're trashing somebody's reputation here on the radio, and I can't respond to it. So, I'm going to move on. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Actually, he wasn't even trashing someone's reputation. He was trashing someone's family's reputation who was a guest on this show.
Yeah.
That's
hello,
just like verboten.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Michael, you're on the air.
Okay, great. By the way, I have a question I need to ask you real quick, and if you can answer it, then I'll follow up with it. kind of like the birds. Our question is there one singularity in our existence that's causing all of the problems, whether morally, economically, or politically?
I don't know. I mean, it would be tempting to you know, everybody's always looking for the ultimate solution to everything, you know, the unified field theory, but I don't know, Michael. I would say our culture. Most of our problems begin with our culture. I wrote a book called Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight about that. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Whoa. Mark wants to say the left is becoming like the thought police, so that should be interesting. Stick around. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Let me recommend to you an article by Katrina Vandenhoevel in today's Washington Post. And the title of this is Time to End the Bloody Ukraine Conflict. And I will just leave it at that. I think it's really, really worth taking 5 minutes of your time to track it down. It's over at WashingtonPost.com. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hold on. Let me take out a speaker.
Sure.
Hi. You know, now I posted a blog to your site one time. It was called, it was likening ideology to religion and making the comparison, saying how ideological extremism, fanaticism, and intolerance are very similar to religious extremism, fanaticism, and intolerance. And I'm afraid that the left is becoming like an ideological Taliban. And granted, our values are opposite to those of the original Taliban, but a well-intentioned authoritarianism and a well-intentioned totalitarianism is still an authoritarianism and is still a totalitarianism. I'm constantly disappointed with people. Most people, when they say they abhor authoritarianism or totalitarianism, what they really mean is they abhor.
These are nice slogans, Mark. What? Give me an example.
An example of which?
I beg your pardon?
An example of what?
Give me an example of left totalitarianism in America.
Totalitarianism. I don't mean government totalitarianism. I mean more totalitarianism, like in a cultish kind of a totalitarianism.
So you're saying that people on the left in the United States who are consistently marginalized, they're consistently ignored by our corporate media because people on the right advocate positions and policies that make more money for the corporate media. After all, it's corporate. The people on the left in the United States, so disempowered, holding, frankly, virtually no power at all in Congress, that they are somehow the Taliban?
Well, I think that their ideological intolerance contributes to their marginalization, because I think a lot of things on the left.
For example,
they come out.
Give me an example, Mark.
I'm hearing
these rhetorical bumper stickers that sound like they came right out of the Rush Limbaugh show, but I don't hear a single example.
When did the left
act like the Taliban? When did they round women up and whip them and put them in burkas?
See, you're not understanding me. I'm saying the values of the left are opposite to those of the Taliban, the original Taliban.
But you're saying the behavior is the same. So where is that behavior? Give me an example.
In general, in specific.
Give me an example.
I would say a hyper enforcement of speech codes, within the left.
For example,
like I think they suppress dissent.
For example,
I think. There are many, but I'm having trouble coming with a.
Well, let me put this to you, Mark. This show is a show on the left. And I'm wondering, and I constantly have conservatives on. I had one in the studio today. I'm wondering how often you hear genuine progressive voices on right-wing talk radio or on Fox News.
Probably never. I'm sure they screen their calls.
Yeah, okay.
Them.
So if we're the Taliban, they're the Taliban on steroids?
No, I'm saying I'm
I put you on the air.
I think that they're, Yeah, well, I'm on the left. I'm not on the right. I'm criticizing the left. I'm on the left.
If you're,
I think
you're on the left and you're saying that the left are the Taliban, you're not on the left.
Yes, I am. I am on the left, Oliver. I don't think that doesn't mean, you know, the left,
right.
You know, the left or the right or the left, you know, the left, you know, you could be, for example, a Republican and
okay.
disapprove of
Mark, give me one example so that we can actually have a discussion here rather than throwing bumper stickers at each other.
Okay, you know, Oh, your guest today, for example, I mean, I think he had some valid points. I don't think you wanted to listen to him. I think there's an element. I think a frank discussion, for example, is necessary. And I think that on these issues, and I think that
a frank discussion about race in the workplace is a very different thing from a white supervisor saying to a black employee, why is everybody all upset about Trayvon Martin and nobody's upset about a black guy who killed a white baby? That's a completely different thing.
You know,
no, Mark, I'm sorry. It's a completely different thing. Andy in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Andy.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. White privilege?
Hey, yeah, you know, I wish, you know, I'm a 45-year-old white guy. And when I was in college, I love you talk about Michigan State. I went to Michigan State, and I graduated from there. And I was a Republican at the time. This is in the early 90s. And I went to Japan for 7 years. And I tell you, my perspective changed quickly, because I had never in my life been treated like a minority. And I'm just telling you, people underestimate, I think white people in particular, how hurtful it is to be judged based on, you know, what you look like.
Yeah.
And how powerless it makes you feel. It was very frustrating for me.
Yeah, the Japanese have a very chauvinistic culture with relation to other races. And even to, you know, like South Koreans. I mean, it's very hard for a South Korean to marry into a Japanese family, for example.
Exactly. And it's worse, actually, if you're, you know, all foreigners. If you're a foreigner, you're a foreigner. You're
Gaijing.
And, you know, yeah, right, you're Gaijing. And,
yeah. And that word, by the way, is to the best of my knowledge, it's the only Japanese word for foreigner. It's also the only Japanese word for crazy person.
You know, I don't, you know, I'm not, I never learned, Gaikokujin, Gaijin, those are outsider, outside person, outside nationality. Yeah, I don't know if it means crazy or not, I can't tell you that, but,
That's what I learned from my Japanese instructor, so. Might be wrong.
Well, no, I believe you, but I'm just telling you that, a lot of people here, especially I think if you're, a white male, and older would benefit by learning how that feels, because you have an idea, not exactly the same, but an idea how minorities feel in this country, and people just underestimate that because it's subtle.
Yeah,
it's subtle racism.
It's subtle, but it's continuous, and that's how it's so destructive. The quote oppression. People say, "Oh, blacks aren't oppressed." No, it's every single day, every single moment, this constant on guard. You know, what does that mean? Where did that come from? Why did that happen? That's got to just grind people down, you know?
It just has to grind people down. And that's how I dealt with it. That's how it stressed me out, too. And eventually I just had to.
You just bailed and came back to the United States. Yeah. Andy, thanks for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. It's a good one. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul.
Oh, hi, Tom. After Mark in Chicago, I have to. Do you mind if I just give a quick little how to call a talk show primer and be a wacky nutcase?
Go for it.
First, what you do is you think of an example of something, and then you construct your wacky ideological argument to decide what that means. Okay.
Right.
You don't come up with wacky ideological arguments and then say, oh, wait a minute, are there any examples? I forgot to come up with them. See, that's doing your work offline.
Right.
You don't upload it later after you call the talk show.
Right.
So, okay, for example, here's one. Here's one a thought example that I have from this weekend. How far, okay, there's bad people in the world, right? ISIS and, okay. So how far away in the world, how far away would bad people have to be before the United States of America would say, "Yeah, they're pretty far away. We don't have to worry about them."
Right.
And the answer to that question, Tom, is freaking outer space. That's where they'd have to be, okay?
Well, no, Paul, I disagree.
What?
All they would have, you know, the far, far away is they would have to be far away from oil reserves. Look at Mugabe in Zimbabwe. You know, look at the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Look at the meltdown that's going on in South Sudan right now, although they are discovering oil there, but the Chinese have staked it all out. So, you know, hey, it's too late for us. And, you know, we'll go up against China rather than Saudi Arabia. So I would say that if you're a really bad person and you don't have any oil or any natural resources to speak of, you're in Fat City.
Well, true enough. But look at it this way. We have gone as far as you can possibly go to make war. Right?
Right.
I would say Korea, Vietnam is about as far away as you can go, right?
Sure.
I mean, Korea is 16 hours ahead of us, so how do you get farther away than that?
Yeah. In fact, 12 hours ahead of us would be exactly the other side of the planet, so.
Right. So we've gone as far as you can possibly go.
Right.
As a matter of fact, Tom, I would say that since there isn't anywhere farther on the planet, it is outer space, actually, where we'd have to go. As a matter of fact, I would say that even Mars is not safe, because if there were bad Martians on Mars and we knew about it, we would be saying we'd rather fight them there than here.
Yeah. Right?
We'd rather fight them on Mars than wait till they come here, because, look, we don't want another smoking gun. We don't want another Orson Welles War of the Worlds here, right?
There you go.
That's the kind of logic. And have you noticed, Tom, that the kind of logic that previous administrations use that are faulty in their myths, they become precedent in American culture. In other words, subsequent administrations, either Democratic or Republican, they use the same thing. Even
well, I think the
bad.
Bush doctrine has been pretty well repudiated, you know, preemptive strikes. It was a violation of the U.N. Charter. I mean, it's been against the law since 1939, but still.
I would argue we don't want to fight them there. For instance, if we had to fight them on Mars, there's no atmosphere on Mars. That means it's very expensive to fight them on Mars, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, Iraq is very expensive. You see, it's not about expense. It's not about really whether they're bad guys. It's whether or not America likes to make war. That's the whole point here.
I would say in part. And also it's about does somebody have an opportunity to make enough money off this that they can buy off enough politicians and public opinion to make it seem like a good idea?
Profitability.
Yeah, and that's where I'd say, you know, originally it was called Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. Paul, thanks for
the call. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yes, when the Bush administration rolled out the original invasion of Iraq, it was called Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. Then they had to change it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. And welcome back 15 minutes before the hour. Bob in Ontario, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. 2 points quickly, if I may.
Certainly.
Number one. Very interesting that so many of our so-called representatives are attending a meeting with Mr. Cheney today.
Yeah.
You know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see somebody take the photographs of the people entering and exiting. So what I called for the other day, maybe can get some momentum. We'll know who to take out of office if they're still listening to this guy.
Yeah, it's meetings with war criminals. I mean, this is...
And the other point, if I may, please... The tragedies that took place in Florida and then further in Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that no one is taken into consideration that the stand the ground your law means to stand your ground against an aggressor.
Right.
The two people who committed those cold-blooded murders were the aggressors. The law applied to Trayvon Martin and anybody else who found themselves in that position. That was never even brought up, and the state itself of Florida never got upset enough to say, hey, we have to follow the law in this state, which starts with the governor, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, Florida
so
did not
in mind when
appropriately
run for president.
Yeah, Florida did not appropriately prosecute that case, or at least that DA did not appropriately prosecute that case. I agree with you. But the law, still, this is a law that the Koch brothers brought us through ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that pairs lobbyists with Republican lawmakers one-to-one, a couple of times a year in meetings all over the country, and the lobbyists bring sample laws, model laws, and they present them to the Republican lawmakers, and if they get a 51% vote out of this meeting of 50 lawmakers and 50 lobbyists sitting in the room together, if they get 51 votes out of it, which means all the lobbyists and one doofus legislator, then it gets introduced into state legislature after state legislature by Republican members of ALEC. And this is not how law should be made in the United States. This is so wrong, it's breathtaking.
I agree, Tom. Would you agree? Agree
to what?
Would you agree that the law did apply to those victims and not to the aggressors
yes.
who shot them?
Yes. Trayvon Martin was a victim. He was not the aggressor. He was walking home from the market. He had Skittles and iced tea. I would argue that the jury instructions in that case were wrongly formulated as well. The jury felt that given the jury instructions, they had no choice but to return the verdict they did. But I don't think relitigating Trayvon Martin at this point is an accomplishment.
I wrote a song when I was younger, Tom. That actually literally applied to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And it was back in those days when we were having so much racial tension. It started as a small, lonely boy walking on a hot, hot summer's day. 110 in the shade in the Everglades, if you know what I mean. That was a civil rights song when I was 13 years old.
Oh.
I don't see that much of a change, even though there were so-called laws to protect people from this type of invasion.
Pardon me. Agreed. And now... Florida has as a governor one of the most notorious corporate felons in the history of America. I mean, it's astounding. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Before the hour, the story coming out, this reported over at the Daily Beast, leaked out of the Republican meeting with Darth Vader, a notorious war criminal Dick Cheney and a group of Republican legislators just a few brief moments ago. Apparently what Cheney said to them was that Obama supported the Muslim Brotherhood, presumably in the election in Egypt. The Egyptians democratically elected a leader who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Obama supported that for a while because it was the outcome of a democratic election. But then, the United States set about undermining that, and that guy's no longer running Egypt. But Cheney's logic was Obama supported the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood was one of the early I'm not even sure they're Salafites. Pro-Muslim nationalist movements, and ISIS is the same thing, and therefore the president supports ISIS, or words to that effect. Right? Here's the chain of causality. Amazing. Robin in Pittsboro, North Carolina. You want to take on veganism, Robin?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. Well, no, I don't want to take on veganism. I just wanted to make a comment about the last segment of your show where you were talking to the professor. I believe it was about food and capitalism.
Right.
Unfortunately, I came in toward the end of it. So the only comment I really wanted to make was I think you were pretty much both agreeing that veganism might be a better way of eating for health and for the planet. And the only comment I wanted to make as a nutritionist is that the way a lot of vegans eat today, I really don't find healthy because if you're supporting that they eat a more, plant-based diet, I definitely would agree with that.
Right.
But a lot of vegans today eat a lot of really unreal foods. They're not natural. They're not real. They're based on soy protein isolates and other man-made products. So
yeah.
I just kind of wanted to throw that out there as food for thought that, balance is probably the key. Eating natural is more the key.
Fruits, and vegetables, whole grains, simple starch, complex starches, excuse me. I don't disagree.
There's a place for meat, too, properly, sustainably raised meat and eaten in moderation. And, again, I kind of often make this comparison to people. I live in a quote-unquote green home that's solar energy and energy efficient. And sometimes building green and eating green for the planet isn't always healthy for the human body.
Yeah.
So meat, there's definitely a place for it in the diet, but I think, like you both mentioned, that the diet in the United States, of course, is heavily processed food and not even...
Hey, Robin, go over to the website nutritionfacts.org, and the physician who runs that, about halfway down the page, he's got three videos, one from each of the last 3 years, where he gives basically an hour-long presentation to a conference. And the one that's 2 years old, he takes the 15 leading causes of death in the United States and says, what's causing these things and how can we address these? Watch that and call the show back, okay, in a week or so?
Okay.
I'd love to get your take on it as a nutritionist. I'm going to move along, but thank you, Robin, for the call. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I really dislike, and it seems like it's more characteristic of people on the right to just take things off of the table and say, we're not going to talk about that. And I think, you know, a lot of people believe that white privilege is a real thing, and they have empirical, you know, evidence to suggest that. And, you know, I think if you anecdotally talk to any African-American person, you know, you know, just ask them their experience.
Or Hispanic or Asian or... Yeah.
So, you know, why do they get away with that? I don't think that that has always been the case, that, you know, they say, well, we're just not going to talk about it. Well, you know, yeah. I'm sorry, you have to talk about
There's a very simple reason, John, why they get away with it. And that's why, that's because, and it's the same reason why, you know, alcoholic families, people don't call out the alcoholic. It's the same reason in abusive situations, people often don't point out the abuse. There are a lot of white people in this country who are quite happy with their white privilege, and they really don't want it challenged. And they get very upset when a college even says, you know, we're going to set aside 10 seats this year out of 1,000. We're going to set aside a couple of seats for people who didn't have white privilege growing up. And so, you know, may not test quite as high as the people who did, even though they still have a powerful intellect. You know, that's how they get away with it. And the audience for that can be found over at Fox So-Called News. It can be found at Right Wing Talk Radio across the nation. It can be found in, and frankly, the poorer a white area is, the more likely they are to characterize themselves as victims, not realizing that they're the victims of capitalism, not of black people. And, you know, so the reason it works, John, is because there's a market for it.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call. I'm with you on that. Felicio, we have just a half a minute. You want to make a quick point?
I'm going to try. As a Spanish and native healthcare practitioner, I've grown up accepting the fact that many liberals have very unconscious ethnocentricity, as well as being sexist. And the example I wanted to give is that I have two patients who are colleagues, who are women physicians, who in two separate instances informed their surgeon and the anesthesiologist that they needed what are called pediatric doses of anesthesia, i.e. they were allergic or very sensitive.
Right.
In both cases, they were ignored. They both flatlined repeatedly.
Wow.
And it was just a miracle that they were brought back.
Aren't you describing sexism, Felicia?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is my point, that sexism and misogyny are just as real and just as awful as racism in the United States. Felicia, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. We will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. If you want this country to work, don't complain. Get up and do something. Go to pdamerica.org and sign up. Go to movetoamend.org and sign up. Go to moveon.org and sign up. Participate. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.